From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a special look at an upcoming documentary film about the Black Panther Party.
Our political representatives in the past have been only pawns for their white political colleagues who do have power. And they depend upon these political colleagues to keep them in office. And they depend upon their political colleagues to justify their actions.
That was the voice of Huey P. Newton, co-founder of the Black Panther Party, during an interview in the Oakland, California jail, where he was awaiting trial in the 1967 shooting of an Oakland police officer, a crime of which he was ultimately acquitted.
The Black Panther Party says that because we don't have these other things, then we must develop still a power base.
Both Newton's life and work and the history of the Black Panther Party itself have been the subject of a number of films, books, and of media scrutiny generally. But the story has yet to be told by those who were there, the revolutionaries themselves, in their own words. That may be about to change if one filmmaker has his way. Dante James is an award-winning filmmaker who's working on an independent feature documentary, The Story of Huey Newton and the Black Panther Party. He says his film will tell the story of the Black Panther Party from inside. It will not be narrated, but rather, the stories and remembrances of Black Panther Party members will carry the narrative.
I've been working with David Hilliard, who was the chief of staff of the Black Panther Party and a founding member, to raise awareness and to put together the finances to do a totally independent film on Huey P. Newton and the Black Panther Party. For years, the Black Panther Party has been defined by outside sources and forces, and they deserve an opportunity to define themselves and their own movement, and to tell the story, their story, from the inside out. And that's the driving force behind making this film and telling the story.
Okay, so what is the story, in a quick summary, that you've seen in speaking with Mr. Hilliard and, I assume, with other members of the party?
Well, clearly, the driving force, the leader and standard bearer of the Black Panther Party, was Huey P. Newton. He was absolutely brilliant, but he also had human frailties. And too often it has been his human frailties that have been emphasized, as opposed to his brilliance as a philosopher, as a historian, as a tactician and leader. And the structure and the way that the Black Panther Party was grounded in the community, always in constant service of the community, those things are often overlooked and never explored because mainstream and corporate control media will go towards the more salacious parts of Huey's life.
The contemporaneous at the time of the founding and the, you know, the growth period of the party in the 60s and was apparently perceived by power as a, you know, huge threat, coming on the heels of the civil rights movement, as it was called, the Civil Rights Act and all of that, during the time of the Vietnam War and mobilization across campuses against that. And
upheaval and decolonization around the world as well, which I think is an important part of it. The historical record is clear, the COINTELPRO memos, and just, of course, the body count with the massive assassination of members of the party. The conditions under which it grew still exist today. Do you think that there's still the perception that this party would be a huge threat even today, or the idea of it?
Absolutely. And that idea that the Black Panther Party would be still a threat, I think, is directly connected to the way that the history is interpreted and defined by mainstream media. I mean, the idea that if you look at the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party, everything in that 10-point program is still relevant today. All of the needs in the 10-point program still need to be addressed. And the most obvious one, which is directly connected to the Black Lives Matter issue and movement, is police brutality and police engagement in African-American communities all across the country. I mean, they asked for one of the points was to get the oppressive capitalist forces out of their community. They asked for an education system that served the needs of the community. All of the issues of the 10-point program are still very relevant today, which speaks to how progressive the Black Panther Party was, and also speaks to why they were embraced by the community. That's the other thing that we're going to do with this film, is that it's not just going to be the Black Panther Party talking about their movement. It's going to be members from the communities that they served talking about the Black Panther Party
and the role that it played in those communities.
Absolutely. And see, David Hilliard, you mentioned the COINTELPRO. During the time, 1969, when over 30 Black Panther Party members were slaughtered across the country, David Hilliard, as chief of staff, was actually leading the party. Huey P. Newton was incarcerated. Bobby Seale was incarcerated out in New Haven. So David assumed leadership of the Black Panther Party. And he has incredible stories in terms of the oppressive tactics that came from COINTEL, but were often initiated by local and state authorities and, of course, infiltrators and provocateurs. It's really just an incredible story.
Yeah, there was no
shortage of them. Pardon me?
Yeah, there was no shortage of them either.
No. The week before, or a couple of weeks before, Fred Hampton was assassinated in Chicago. He was in Oakland with David. The night that Huey P. Newton was shot, they brought Huey, bleeding, to David's house before they took him to the hospital. The night that Bobby Hutton was murdered, David was there. So it's really an inside, it's ability to tell the story from the inside out and for them to define themselves and their movement. We have every issue of the Black Panther Party newspaper.
Wow.
We have 9 hours of film footage that has never been seen. Mm. We have audio recordings that were made when Huey was incarcerated And they would go and have these conversations with Huey and basically give him their reports. We have all of these materials to work with that will enable us to tell the story from the inside out, as I've been saying.
Mm. And, you know, the importance of that is encapsulated in the first item in the 10-point program, the power to determine the destiny of our black community, basically meaning the right of self-determination, which means being able to tell your own story, if nothing else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there have been many. I mean, right now, there are, I guess, two or three films out there on the Black Panther Party. Okay. I know that there is a PBS film. HBO is doing a miniseries. But all of those, and this is not a criticism of those two entities, but both of those entities are connected to corporate mainstream media.
Right.
And I think that it's really, really important for this film to be told outside of the grip of corporate control media, so that the filters that can often be in place are not something that we have to deal with.
Just to sidetrack for a moment, and maybe it's at the heart of the matter, actually, but as you attempt to put together financing for this and, you know, all of the mechanical aspects of the apparatus of producing a film, what kind of resistance are you running into, if any?
That's a very interesting question, because when David and I first started talking about this, one of the things that I told him I had to do, I said, well, David, I need to go off and read, and I have to do some research, and then we'll talk. So I read David's book. I read Huey's book. I read Bobby Seale's book and various other scholarly material. And I came back to David, and I said, David, I'm willing to do this, but I have a stipulation. He says, what is that stipulation? The stipulation is that it has to be totally independent, that we cannot deal with foreign foundations or corporate money, that it has to be independent. We have to find the money independently. He says, okay, I agree with that. We went on a letter-writing campaign and drafted correspondence that was not from me. It was actually from David and Frederica Newton, because if anyone has any ownership of this history and have a right to tell this history, it would be them. And we wrote to many people who we know have the wherewithal, and people that we thought, based on their current activities and current positioning of themselves, would be receptive and would understand the need to tell this story independently. And none of them. And it really serves no purpose to name names, but if one will just think and make a list, one can come up with the most obvious people that we targeted. Are you still there?
Yes.
Oh. And these are all African American. Most of them are African Americans, people who framed themselves as being committed to the struggle of African American and oppressed people in this country and around the world. And none of them were receptive to joining us in this effort. And we were not asking people to fund it. We were asking people to invest because we feel like it can be a solid investment. You know, it's not going to do Star Wars type money, but it's a solid investment. It's a story that needs to be told. It's history that needs to be preserved. And when all those efforts did not bear fruit, then we decided that what we need to do is go to the people. And in a sense, that makes good common sense, because that's what the Black Panther Party was about, is in service to the people. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we can find people throughout the country who recognize the importance of this history and will make a small or whatever contribution they can make to our Indiegogo crowdfunding site.
I'm wondering if the problem for people who are, you know, in the business is that they already know what kind of a storm will be produced when this film comes out, and perhaps even some barriers that may pop up moving forward, such as distribution.
Well, I think that's a I think that is could be a concern for some of them. But as an individual who does not have resources, I think that, or I'm hopeful that if and when I ever do have resources, that it will free me to speak more freely and to use the platform that one has when you have resources to speak to issues that do not get spoken to. But that has not been our experience thus far.
I can definitely relate to that. Believe me, I can relate to that. I want to go back to the program, 10-point program, which was, you know, at the heart of it. The first thing about it, and this is something that Glenn Ford just spoke of at the Black is Back conference in D.C. a few weeks ago, which is the fact that this 10-point program is a list of demands. Like you mentioned earlier, Black Lives Matter, and you know the groups that are popping up now on the issue of police murders, police brutality generally, and the nature of policing. Even you get a critique of that, but at the bottom of it, not much in the way of demands. This was an entire platform of demands.
Absolutely, and it went from all the way from safety issues to the courts, to basic kind of survival issues. One of the things that, one of the many things that I've talked to David about is the health initiatives that came out of the Black Panther Party community programs. Now, something that people really aren't aware of, and that corporate control media will not address, is the fact that community programs in chapters all around the country were designed by those chapters in service of those communities. Like, for instance, Wilmington, North Carolina had a legal program and a program to get people to the prisons to visit their loved ones. It was one of the strongest chapters. There was a process that these chapters had to go through to become a sanctioned chapter by the Black Panther Party. They had to go through political education courses so that they understood where the Black Panther Party was going philosophically, what they were trying to do, why they were trying to do it. These are things that are just totally ignored. There was a very strong chapter up in Seattle that had innovative community-based programs. And it's one of the things that we're going to do in the context of this film is explore and expose some of those programs. And many of them ended up going mainstream. David told me the story of in the Oakland office, there was a young woman who would come to the office every day to work and make a contribution. And she was always sickly. And people in the office assumed that she was on drugs. She would have to leave and come back, and she was on drugs. One day, David has a conversation with her, and he finds out that she has sickle cell anemia. That leads to an entire series of articles in the Black Panther Party newspaper on sickle cell anemia. And the paper at that time was being edited by David Du Bois, Dr. Du Bois' son. And it was that pressure, okay, that not solely that pressure, but that pressure helped bring the issue of sickle cell anemia to light. And the area Congress people became supportive of the effort. And eventually, the Nixon administration,
right,
the Nixon administration passed or supplied resources for sickle cell anemia research and care.
Yeah, I mean, it became so widely popularized. There were TV commercials and everything about it back then. You know,
yes.
While you're on the medical thing, you know, the popular culture has not been able to suppress the fact of the breakfast programs and all of that. That is widely known even now. But the medical program occurs within the context of the Barefoot Doctors program in China that began in the mid-60s and particularly became policy in like 1967, 1968. And of course, that was at the beginnings of the Cuban medical program also, which is known, you know, around the world now. This was developed partially and in tandem with what the Panthers were doing.
Well, the historical record will show that, again, this is Huey and David in terms of their scholarship. They were very much aware of these revolutionary movements all around the country. I mean, all around the world. And in a sense, use portions of all of them to shape their philosophy in terms of what would work here and what the needs were here. And of course, Huey went to China.
Right.
Of course, Huey was in exile in Cuba.
That's right.
And that's another part of this story that gets ignored. The fact that they were aware of and monitored revolutionary movements all around the world and did not see what was happening to Black people in this country solely as a U.S.-based phenomenon, that they saw it, the struggle of oppressed people, in a much larger context. And I think that is also one of the reasons why the FBI and the federal government deemed them as being so dangerous.
Yeah, you know, you have the legacy of Dr. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, people that were looking at, and Malcolm, the, you know, the international character of the oppression of Black people in this country. And they were doing work on the ground here with an eye on this global movement against, you know, against that oppression.
Yes. Yeah. Another point that I think we need to explore a little bit is the fact that the Black Panther Party was also very progressive in terms of gay rights. Mm-hmm. They were, though they were internal issues, they were progressive in regard to women's rights. Mm-hmm. And they built coalitions with other organizations, white organizations, that where they found common ground with. So it wasn't, I mean, the name the Black Panther Party, I think sometimes people will think of that as in an isolationist context. Right. But clearly that was not the case.
Right. And therein lied the real danger to the establishment. And they acknowledged it, again, in things that were pulled out later, looking at COINTELPRO and other government programs.
Yes.
Okay, I'd love to talk more about this film, but we're running short on time, and you have some other films, and I wouldn't mind talking about that. In particular, my interest in jazz. The okay. film that you did, but go ahead, whatever you think is most important for people to know.
Well, the Harlem and Montmartre Paris Jazz Story was a film that was produced for the PBS series Great Performances, and that was to this date my last PBS film. It was a good experience, and I think it was a good film. But
National Emmy. Right, you got an Emmy.
Yes, yes. No, but actually, the Emmy was for Slavery in the Making of America.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. That one won, I don't know, something at the Pan-African International Film Festival in Cannes, which I didn't get to go to, but but it won. At any rate, so it was that film and... just this ongoing relationship with PBS, and I'm not being critical of PBS, okay? But the fact that there are these filters, both in the station and in the PBS programming hierarchy, and the nature of PBS's relationship, funding relationship with the right. government and corporations and so right. forth, and... the nature of those relationships puts limits on what one can say right. within the context of your films. And I am at a point in time in my life as an artist, as a filmmaker, as an African-American male, where and we're at a time in history where I feel like I need to make the strongest statements that I can possibly make. So consequently, I've moved on and I'm trying to do everything independently. One of the things that I'm trying to do independently is a series of dramatic short films that are based on African-American literature. I'm really concerned about the kind of images and the way that the Black experience is portrayed. And if one goes to our literature, you can find an incredible array of stories that explore the complexity of the Black experience in the context of larger humanity. And that's really what I'm interested in doing. So we're hopeful that we can put together the funding to make those films. And they will not be... PBS-based films, you know, with the new modes of distribution. There is an explosion in the way that one can get product to people, and I'm hopeful that that will open the doors for more progressive thought and more progressive interpretations of the Black experience.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.